Thank you very much, Amy. Wonderful presentation. I now have the honor of introducing our keynote speaker. You should all know her. She is one of the most dedicated individuals I know in the HIV space, pushing us to achieve targets that just years ago we just dreamt about or hoped about. Ambassador Birx.
You're going to be really
asking to keep it short. Ambassador Deborah Birx, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, and dear friend.
Thank you. Thank you, Jose. I wanted him to be short because I didn't know how long this was going to take to get it to work after that last issue. And I'm just, oh, wow, they really made sure that was in there very tightly. Oh, perfect. I just want to, again, thank Jose for his vision and his leadership and the organizer's leadership. I read all the abstracts, and it was really quite amazing to read your work. And not only to read the honesty in the work and to read the way that you demonstrated that it's not just about what your immediate findings are, but you continue to ask questions on how to get things to a better place. And I think that level of honesty is not often evident when people do presentations and abstracts. And I think really showing that when you ask a question, it causes more questions to be asked with the data that you get, I think is really the exciting piece that this group brings together. So I just wanted to just take a moment to thank you for your work and then, of course, get into the presentation if I can get. Well, at least that's my computer, so that's a good thing. And I know you've been sitting, so I will hopefully go really quick with a lot of data so that you can see the translation of your knowledge and what you've really taught us and how we have taken your lessons and applied them globally and really tried to create a constant interaction between the people doing work here in the United States and the people doing work globally. Not to mention that these are your taxpayer dollars in action. We take that very seriously, and we really look at everything that we do every day to make sure that we're doing it in the best quality, the most impactful, the most transparent way that really reflects the generosity and the humility of the American people. Now, when you look at the epidemic today, and I'm just going to give you a brief snapshot of that. This is the world represented by burden of disease. And I really was grateful that Amy put in there about matching dollars to burden of disease, because that is what we've been trying to do over the last 24 months. And it's a very difficult thing, because you could see in her map there were differences of 30-fold between certain states and rates of HIV. It's the same way globally. And so when you look at this map, 72% of the burden of disease is in sub-Saharan Africa. But you can see other countries represented there in the light green. So the lighter the green, the lower the prevalence, the bigger the size of the country, the distorted nature of the burden of disease. So you can see that there's very high prevalent areas. You can see Lesotho and Swaziland on this slide. And those are very tiny countries. So that tells you that their burden of disease and their prevalence is in the 20 to 30% range. So that's 1 in 3 adults HIV positive. And that's a very different type of epidemic than if you turned your attention to India. Now, not really seen on this slide is Russia. And I want to mention that because in the only place in the world where the epidemic is substantially expanding with rates of new infections is Eastern Europe and Central Asia. 85% of those new infections are in Russia. So that's a place where we don't, as the U.S. government, have a substantial HIV/AIDS program. And it's an area where there is unrelenting stigma and discrimination to those who are HIV positive. And so I always like to recognize that there are pockets in the world with the expanding epidemics where we really don't have a good reach from the United States. Now, when UNAIDS published this document, their fast-track strategy that led to the 90-90-90, they put up this circle that we were headed to 2.5 million new infections a year. Now, those of you who watch HIV infection rates year after year, day after day, we're right now at 2 million a year. So when you think you've done a great job globally as a collected humanity to really decrease the incidence of HIV infections, you ask yourself how we're going to have a 25% increase in the number of HIV infections and thus the burden of disease, and headed to a historic potential of 100 million HIV-positive patients since the beginning of the epidemic. So when we looked into this, they also presented the counterpoint that we could get to 200,000 new infections a year. Now, that also captured our attention, but we were still bothered by the 2.5 million new infections a year. And this is the graphic that was in that document of the fast-track strategy. Now, that star represents where we are today. So already, we are behind. We're on that red line that takes us to 28 million new infections, a historic high, and we need to figure out how to get on the blue line as a global entity. And this was the real question that we've been looking into for the last 3 years, but it still bothered me, that red line. And I'm going to talk a little bit about where that red line comes from. And it just did steal that thunder. It comes from what is called in Southern Africa and South Africa itself, Namibia and Botswana, the youth bulge. But in the rest of Africa, the youth wave, where we're headed to 60% of the population under 18 by 2030. These are our young women. These are our young men at greatest risk for HIV. So when you have 40% more of a population at risk, even if you've decreased the incidence by 40%, you end up with still the same burden of disease. And so that is really where our focus has turned. We also have spent a lot of time talking about sustainability. It's a big buzzword in global health and development. And when we looked at this, it was reminded that we can't really talk about sustainability. You can't talk about transferring and giving to a country in their total ability to pay when you have expanding epidemic. Because no country can continue to pour in the resources necessary for an ever-expanding epidemic. So the real key to sustainability is epidemic control. So about 2 years ago, we came up with this right things in the right places, right way. We used to say right time. I'm a little impatient. Now we say right now. But this really then led to UNAIDS putting out its location and population document, really trying to get public health officials and leaders within countries to focus resources according to burden of disease. Now, that may seem incredibly logical to you all, but in many countries, because of many reasons, resources don't always go according to burden of disease. They may go for political reasons. They may go for cultural reasons. There may be a whole information matrix that figures into how resources are allocated. Now, President Obama took that moment between the celebration of the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals and the launching of the Sustainable Development Goals to announce new targets for HIV. And he not only announced new targets for his administration, he announced new targets for the next administration. And that's always a great thing when you have an administration change, to have the next president having to implement these approved targets that the world heard at the SDG speech of President Obama. Now, these are very aggressive targets with nearly 13 million men, women, and children on treatment. But for the first time, two very aggressive prevention targets, recognizing that we understand that there's a youth wave and a youth bulge, and we need to prevent new infections in young men and young women. And this young women target is extraordinarily aggressive, of a 40% decline in the incidence of infection of young women. But as I stated, this is the minimum to keep the epidemic from expanding. This is just what we need to keep the epidemic from expanding. So although it's incredibly aggressive, it is the minimum. Now, for those of you who work in the government, when you develop new targets, you've got to go and present them to the Office of Management and Budget. They're there to protect the president from announcing targets that are not achievable. So when I went and said to them, we want this really aggressive young women's target, they said to me, where is the data that shows that you can do this? And I said, well, basically, we don't have any. Because we have studies that said if we looked at education, if we looked at violence prevention, if we looked at community engagement, if we strengthened the families, it's the suggestion if we put all those together, 1 + 1 will be 10. And that's what we're banking on. And I think the White House understood, and our incredible budget people understood, that this really, again, was the minimum, and it captured their attention. Now, we feel like we have to achieve these goals, and we focused a lot of energy on them. But I wanted to present to you the challenges and some of our solutions that we have come up with. One of our biggest challenges is enormously low testing yield. And what do I mean by that? Last year, we supported testing of nearly 70 million people, but we directly supported, in other words, with commodities and the individual doing the test, 45 million HIV tests last year. The prevalence of that test yielded 4.1%. Now, we work only in high-burden countries. And when we're working in concentrated epidemics, we only work among the key populations. So to have a prevalence across all of PEPFAR of 4% means that we're missing the majority of the individuals at risk for HIV. So we really had to go back and look at our testing strategy. Now, this is just from Asia and the Pacific, and I have Thailand illustrated there. But in every country we work, a key population, MSM, sex worker, people who inject drugs, prevalence is all over 10%. And this is the people who, this is the sex workers, and this is the people who inject drugs. So we know that we should be having, if we're in the right networks, if we're reaching the right people, we should have minimum prevalence of 8 to 12%. We also looked at every single clinical cascade from every single country. We've been really working on making data visible, making data transparent. If you go to PEPFAR.gov, you'll see the PEPFAR data down to the district level in every single country. But this has allowed us to look at every single site, every single district, every single region, every single country, every single region of the world, and say, where are our gaps? Well, you can see in Laos and Thailand, there's a huge gap between the people who are HIV positive and those who know their status. Less than a third know their status. So then we looked at what could we do that would be innovative, and we really put a challenge out to our teams in last year's planning that their testing yields were enormously low, and what were they going to do about it? And then we started measuring it quarterly. Now, some countries went to monthly so that they could look at every single partner and every single site monthly to really see if they were reaching the individuals at risk. The reason this also came about in Swaziland, prevalence of 28%, our testing yields were 1.2%. Now that is almost impossible. You would have to have only the people who knew that they were negative coming in for testing. Data really tells a story. So this is what they did in northern Thailand. There was always this belief. Now, there's a lot of perceptions in global health. So there's a lot of statements of best practices. But when you ask the people who talked about the best practice, what was their comparator? There is never a comparator. So now we require, if you're going to present something as a best practice, it has to be compared to something so that it's better than something else. So the general understanding was that community-paid support volunteers that worked with the networks were the optimal way to reach into networks of people who inject drugs, of men who have sex with men, and into sex workers. And they would become the navigators. Well, this is a study where, this is not a study, it's actually in practice. This is our program in northern Thailand, where they've actually recruited peers within the network itself and incentivized them to bring in other individuals within the network to be tested and receive treatment or to receive PrEP. And you can see that in the incentivized group, the number of HIV positives found was more than two times in the community support group. So this is starting to shape a picture that maybe our community, paid community support workers, aren't deep enough into those networks to really understand the groups at risk. And when we did behavioral questionnaires on the different testers of these two groups, it was that middle group of incentivized peer outreachers that came in with the first-time testing individuals, that highest prevalence, least likely to use condoms, and least likely to use lubrication. So it was really a higher risk group, a group that was more in need of our prevention interventions and a group that was more in need of our treatment. And so this has really been exciting, and we created the ability for our countries to meet together and share together now twice a year, where they can take data that is in evolution and from the program level and talk about it with one another and really share these kinds of insights. We just did this again last week in Bangkok, and the Ukrainian group, people who were working with people who inject drugs, had exactly the same observation. So then when you start to see innovations that are coming from different groups in the world, you can really begin to see the excitement of this kind of data sharing. Another challenge that we had was the rate of new infections in adults. Now, because of our tremendous, tremendous progress in preventing mother-to-child transmission, a lot of our decline in new infections over the last decade have been driven by this more than 60% decline in new pediatric infections. But when you separate all infections into pediatrics and adults, over that same time period, you see almost no impact on transmission between adults. Now, this was a real wake-up call to us. This is UNAIDS data just split out between pediatrics and adults. And it really showed us that we had made tremendous progress in one area and less progress in another that was really the core driver of new infections of the future. Now, again, going back to our countries, this is from Kenya, just from a month ago. This is their clinical cascade last year, fiscal year 15, which ended in September 30th, less than a year ago. Now, this was very interesting to us because particularly those of us who are women in the group thought that the problem with men was they were defaulting. You know, they would come in, they would get tested, they would get referred to care, they would decide that was all too complicated and stop coming. That's what we thought. But when you look at the clinical cascade, and again, everything is age and sex disaggregated, the male cascade is exactly equal to the female cascade. In other words, men that are diagnosed with HIV around the world are just as likely as women to come to the clinic, get on treatment, and stay on treatment. Just as likely. Just as likely. The difference is men are tested significantly less. So whereas we have achieved 95% coverage of testing of all adult women, we've only achieved 74% coverage in men. So now we know what the issue is. The issue is not referral, linkages, staying on treatment. It's just finding them and getting them tested. And remember, we were giving a very complicated public health message. Until the release of the new WHO guidelines, we said to people, oh, yes, you have HIV, but you're not sick. So come back when you're sicker. That's what we were saying. And we said that for 13 years. So if you're a male and you come in and you're told you have a disease but you don't need anything and you're not sick, which is the way you would read that, because if you were sick, you would get something, and then we wonder why there's still ongoing transmission. So now we have a uniform public health message. If you're HIV positive, you have a deadly disease that changes your immune system and does damage even when you can't see it and you need to be on treatment. A uniform message, whether you're pregnant or not pregnant, whether you're male or female, whether you're an adolescent or a child. And that simplifies everything and makes that public health message understandable. Understandable that you need treatment for yourself if you're positive, to preserve your immune system and to thrive, and you need treatment so you don't transmit. It becomes a universal, straightforward message. Now, I didn't want you to just think only Kenya had that same clinical cascade. Again, the orange bars are women, the blue bars are men. This is Zimbabwe, absolutely identical in percentages in those that are retained and suppressed between men and women. So this was very exciting to all of us, that this was like a myth buster that we discovered about 2 months ago. Now, this is where I wanted you to really focus on the global population. So the Millennium Development Goals, that Millennium Development Goal 4 which was to reduce childhood mortality, to improve under five survival, was wildly successful. Now remember, this was started in 2000, went to 2015. Okay, 70% improvement in under five survival. Now, what does that mean? That means that all those 70% more five-year-olds are now 10 and 15. There's no schools for them. There's no jobs for them because no one planned for success. So we had this great goal, but we were focused on other fives. And I don't know whether we thought that they wouldn't turn 10. But now after this huge investment of improving immunization and treating diarrhea and respiratory diseases, treating their malaria, preventing mother-to-child transmission, all that investment that we had in that child that was thriving, now we owe it to them to maintain that thriving and ensure they thrive AIDS-free. So this is the demographic pyramids. This is just from South Africa. In South Africa, when the epidemic started, they had 70 million 10 to 29-year-olds, 7 million. They now have 10 million. Now, they truly have a youth bulge that over the next decade, because of the decrease in fertility rates, their actual numbers of adolescents will start to decline. But this is the rest of Southern Africa. Now, their fertility rates are that orange line. This is a very complicated slide with a lot of data on it. But if you look at those pyramids, now the real key that you probably cannot see at all is the x-axis. And the x-axis in 1950 goes from 0 to 20 million. The x-axis in 2050 goes from 0 to 200 million. So we had 25 million young women between 10 and 24 in 1950. We'll have 300 million by 2050. Without the secondary schools, without an ever-rising youth unemployment, and all of those structural barriers that we know result in risk to HIV, is ever expanding. So this is how you go from 2 million new infections today to 2.5 million. And how do you stop that? And this is not a matter of just a biomedical intervention. This is a matter of how we're working in the communities to ensure that people have opportunities and opportunities that ensure wellness. Now, so we came up with a solution. We call it DREAMS, Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored, and Safe Young Women. It really was born out of the work that you do. Over the last 2 years, we've been traveling around domestically, and every place we have gone, whether it's Oakland or South LA, whether it's Atlanta or Miami or Fort Lauderdale, or whether it's New York, we really talk to the individuals about what community outreach they have for young people and what they're doing. Because as shown on that previous demographic, the same risk that puts young men of color at risk in the United States is putting young women at risk in Southern Africa. And we think we can learn on how to do a better job. 71% of all the adolescents' infections are in young women, 1,000 a day. Now, what is happening? Now, this data is Koresha Karim's data that was recently presented by Yogan Pillay. What they believe is men somewhere between 25 and 29 are infecting young women between 15 and 20, who then go on to infect young men between 20 and 22. So it's a very tight age span. So this concept of sugar daddies in this cross-generational 45-year-old to a 16-year-old is not really what is happening. It's more 25 to 16, and what does that look like? And if you could break that cycle, you would have almost a million less infections a year. So that's the cycle we're looking at breaking. On the construct of we now have huge issues now that we've documented it, in 11 countries, we've completed violence against children surveys. This was a survey that was mandated out of GWE, the office started by Secretary Clinton for her concerns about young women around the world. I asked the CDC while I was down there to do these violence against children surveys. We thought we would do two or three countries. Now we're up to 19. But the consistency of young women's first sexual experience being coerced or specifically rape in country after country after country, so that when you have 25 to 35% of children's first sexual experience being violent, and it's that many, then every girl either has had it happen to them or knows someone. And this is where we need to bring the communities and church together. Because Sunday morning, the victims and the perpetrators are sitting there in the congregations. We have to have a comprehensive response to the plight of young women, and we can no longer make it acceptable. There are legal frameworks in each of these countries now where we have done the violence against children surveys, against rape, against sexual violence. But the communities are not coming forward with the information to result in the perpetrators being prosecuted. And this is the work that we have to do together. So we launched the Dreams Partnership. We put originally $300 million in. It's a public-private partnership. We added another $85 million. We will continue to add money to this partnership because we believe it's absolutely key and essential. These are the Dreams countries. They are the highest burden countries in all of sub-Saharan Africa, with the highest risk to young people. There are 10 of them. Now, this is a complicated slide, but it's just meant to show that we put the young woman at the center. About 85% of that $385 million is invested into the young woman itself, herself, in empowerment. Another about 20% in the community to get at this gender-based violence issue against young women. A third to strengthen the family to make it unacceptable to allow their child to be exposed to gender-based violence and to ensure that young girls stay in school. There's that tiny little bit, 5% invested in men, but we put another $150 million over here to find men and get them on treatment, because remember, we had that gap in diagnosis of men. When we started traveling and went out to South LA, if you overlay HIV prevalence versus years of high school education. So the darker, the yellow area, the darker is the higher HIV prevalence. The lighter purple are the less years of high school education. And you can see that they very much overlay. And that lower high school education rates have resulted in higher HIV prevalence. And there was a study out of Botswana where they added a year of education 10 years ago. And they studied those men and women 10 years later. And just that 1 year, going from 9 years of schooling to 10 years of schooling, resulted in a third decline in HIV prevalence. A third, 10 years later. 10 years later. The immunization of that 1 year of additional secondary education. So we launched the Dreams Innovation Challenge to really bring new partners to the fight. We opened this up. We had 865 applications. We have whittled that down a little bit from the letter of intents and asked, I think, about 165 to 180 to provide a full application. These are very exciting applications, really focused in building young women's empowerment at the very grassroots level, all through retention in secondary school, to changing in the community, to ensuring that we're utilizing data in an effective way. One of the other solutions that we've been working on is male circumcision, and I wanted to give you an update about where we are. We've done about 9 million circumcisions. Of course, we do everything is analyzed by country, so we can look at country performances quarterly, so we can see how each site is doing in both addressing its targets and its results in a positive way. But we're also looking at this age banding. Because, again, we have flat resources, so we had to focus our resources on that orange band, the 15 to 29-year-olds. And you can see we're not doing so great. So this is the band where we'll have the biggest impact on the epidemic, and they account for less than a third of our circumcisions. So we're working on not only doing circumcisions, but doing circumcision and saturating in this orange band and then going down to the blue band to continue to expand circumcision. This is just South Africa. The details aren't important, but this is what allows us at a glance to look at every single circumcising site on every quarter to look at those results and see if they're performing. So the dark areas are the areas that need the most circumcisions, and the purple, size of the purple, is each site, how many circumcisions they're doing. And so you can see at a glance that there's some sites that are not performing. Those are the very light purple sites. And so we've learned by looking at things in a very disaggregated way, partners are paying attention. They're looking at their own data. They're improving their sites because they know that their site is going to be visible on maps like these, and these maps now are online. The other key area that we've been working on is expanding what we now call test and start. And we call it test and start because we really wanted to recognize the importance of the START trial and really recognize how that translation of research into action and policy is absolutely key. So what did we do? Well, first, you may have heard that we've eliminated the care indicator. Now, don't get nervous. We did that because the care indicator was being utilized to keep people in pre-ART care and counting that. So by eliminating the care indicator and only going to the treatment indicator, it forces partners into recognizing that PEPFAR is supporting the care continuum through the goal of treatment and viral suppression. And so that's the first part. We also put forward an innovation and impact fund, specifically an impact fund where countries who moved to the WHO policies of starting immediately would receive additional dollars. And if they don't, they lose money. So we believe at the end of this COP session, which ends this September, that 100% of the PEPFAR countries that have prevalences over 5% will have moved to test and start. And this will be the most rapid adoption of the WHO guidelines in the historic of WHO guidelines. But I wanted you to know that we're looking very carefully at the numbers we have on treatment, but also the retention on treatment, and also the viral load. And we have a lot of work to do in getting viral load out there. Now, we've been looking at how in a neutral global budget, where you know how much you have in the global fund, you know how much you have in PEPFAR, and you know how much countries are investing, how could we double the number of people on treatment today? Because that's what we need to do. And we've been looking at this very carefully, and it is almost possible. You can get 80% of the money that you need to double the individuals on treatment if you change your service delivery model to those recommended by the WHO, where 80% of the clients who are stable go to every 6 months follow-up, every 6 months for medication. We believe that this is the breakthrough not only for HIV and wellness, but for the treatment of hypertension and diabetes. Right now, clients are picking up their drugs every month or every 2 months, standing in line, losing a day of work throughout the globe. There is now a dislink between retention and adherence because their clinical follow-up may be every 3 months, but they may be required every monthly to pick up drug. So the physician and the nurses believe that the patient is retained because they're coming 4 times a year, but they're not picking up drug 8 of those months. This is very, very damaging to the entire issue of resistance and retention and adherence. And we're working very hard on this, but you can see this is a global fund pictogram of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. The yellow countries require every 2 months pickup of drugs. The red, monthly. You can see there's only one country there with 3 month refills. This is the work that we have to collectively do to change this paradigm. It was a paradigm that was started at the beginning of PEPFAR and the initiation of the Global Fund when we initiated treatment in the individuals who were very ill. And they did need to be followed more frequently. But that was 12 years ago. And now people that have HIV/AIDS have 300, 500, 700 CD4 cell count. And we have to recognize that and change our clinical practice, and we have to do that together. We also, this recognizes the importance of community and the number of countries that don't have community engagement. But what if we did this? What if we were able to double the number of people on treatment by changing the service delivery model? This is what happens with the deaths and incidence of HIV. We drop it by more than 50% over the next 5 years, and we start looking like the fast track document. It not only, this is data from Botswana, it not only ends the HIV/AIDS expansion pandemic, but it ends the TB epidemic in Africa also. By starting people on treatment immediately, the blue line shows you the impact on the number of TB cases. And in Botswana alone, it saves over $30 million because of the decreased number of TB cases. I'm not going to go into details with PMTCT because we've gone quite well with that. I just wanted to point out one country, Nigeria, where we have not, despite a huge amounts of investment, really succeeded. And we've really put additional effort there. I think many of you know that children and children's treatment has been behind adult treatment. So we launched the Accelerating Children's Treatment with the CIF organization, and we have now, will well exceed our goal of doubling the number of children on treatment. And this is because our orphan and vulnerable children partners who are working with children in the community were able to identify immediately sick children and refer them to treatment. And because of that, we doubled the number of children tested last year from 2 million to over 4 million. And because of that, we added just in the ag countries another 189,000 children on treatment. Remember, 50% of children die before their second birthday if they're not on treatment. So this has really been a really important piece. I wanted to end with the right places piece, and I'm going to go very quickly through a whole series of slides, which hopefully you had a lot of caffeine. So the right place piece, as was illustrated in the national strategy, has been a really difficult discussion. Now, we know in the United States we've been mapping, this is LA County, HIV incidence and prevalence by zip code. But that had not been done routinely in countries. Countries reported prevalence at the national level, sometimes by the regional level, but never by the county level. So we've been working with country after country. This is now Uganda, utilizing and translating all of our data to HIV prevalence at the county level. And this was very eye-opening to district health managers, because they can now see at a glance that HIV isn't uniform, that there's areas of very high burden of disease and very high transmission zones, and then there's areas shown in the very light, light, light coral of very low burden of disease and very few HIV-positive individuals. And this allowed us to then map 100% of our sites. We have this for every country. If you go online, you'll be able to see these maps. This is every single PEPFAR-supported site in Uganda, and you can see how they are displayed. And then this is their testing numbers, so we track everything by where the high yields are coming from, who has to do better, what sites are performing well. This is at a glance that tells you the coverage. So you can see the number of people on treatment in green and the total number of people living in the blue. So you can say immediately whether you have 60% coverage, 70% coverage of treatment by every district. You can look at circumcision and their performance by the district. This is our Orphans and Vulnerable Children's Program, and this is our DREAMS locations. So everything is mapped down to the district level. Well, what does that mean? This is Rwanda. This is where they were last year, because we're on the fiscal year, not calendar year. So this was end of September last year. This is their 90-90-90, and you can see how close they are, but not equal across all districts. We really changed our investments to ensure that all districts have coverage. This is where they will be at the end, this September 30th. And you can see they're very close to the 90-90-90. You can see the number of districts that are now saturated. And 15 months from now, Rwanda will have overachieved and be at 95-95-95 for all of their parameters, and all of their districts will have coverage except for two of 95%. And here's their viral load coverage today. Now, I know a lot of cities would be thrilled to have these viral load coverages. So this is what's possible when you're utilizing data in real time and really working with partners and sites. Now you might say, okay, Rwanda, low prevalence, small country. Let's go to Zambia. Again, here's their map of burden of disease. You can see there's pockets of very high burden of disease. This is where they were with saturation last year, this year, next year. The country then will be at 77% of the second 90 within the next 15 months. This is Swaziland, same thing. This is where they are now. They're already will be at 90, 90, 90 for women by the end of fiscal year 17, and almost to the third 90 for male, again in 15 months. So this use of data has really driven us to look where are gaps. How do we find innovative solutions at the site level, and how do we take those to scale? Finally, I talked about this last year, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but we have spent the last 12 months doing sexual and gender diversity training with 100% of our staff, just like was just discussed with HRSA. You have to start with your own staff and ensure that your own staff don't have cultural biases that transcend in how they treat clients and how welcoming they are for young women who need commodities or supplies. Are they turned away from the clinic? Are young men turned away? And this really looked at how much enacted stigma was occurring in Geneva and Jamaica by the healthcare providers themselves. And this is what we have to be constantly conscious of. We need to be constantly going to our clinics and seeing if they're welcoming and seeing if they're opening to races, gender, independent of sexual orientation. We know civil society plays a critical role, yet we weren't consulting with civil society and communities. So what we've done is now civil society and communities are engaged in our COP planning activities at all aspects of our COP planning activities, from looking at the data, looking at our gaps, proposing solutions, and they're now in 100% of our reviews. The government was always there, and what we've told countries is if the government partners are there, community partners need to be there. And this has been difficult because what we didn't realize when we started talking about this is that not everybody grew up in the epidemic. So what may have seemed natural to us who are, well, there's a lot of young people in the audience, but those people who are closer to my age and were able to experience the epidemic from the eyes and through the eyes of the advocates who cared for one another and demanded more for everyone, not just themselves. It was difficult for our 30-somethings and 40-somethings that hadn't experienced that to go out and work at the community because the community sometimes was loud. And the community sometimes was demanding. And believe it or not, sometimes we didn't have the answer. And when a physician or a nurse doesn't have the answer, it made them very nervous that they couldn't immediately respond with a data point or a clarification. And so this has been difficult for our teams to have this level of transparency and openness. But it's been absolutely essential because it's changing our ability to reach the people who need our support. The other piece that we've added in this is we've now added a PrEP indicator. So we can really know where PrEP is being utilized, how it's being utilized, but in an age and gender disaggregated way, so we can start tracking this information and the data. And we've invested an additional $30 million in civil society development to really ensure that there's vibrancy there 10 years from now. We're not talking about ending the AIDS pandemic by those who are no longer, by eliminating HIV/AIDS. We're talking about ending the pandemic by allowing people to thrive and grow and live with HIV/AIDS. That will require us to have continuous community engagement for the 15-year-olds, for the 25-year-olds, for the 65-year-olds. Because in that continuity of life, the needs changing each time, and we have to make sure our programs change with them. So we're excited about the opportunity. We're excited about the Sustainable Development Goals because for the first time, the United States and the globe are one. What's happening in South LA, Miami, Atlanta, where young men are presenting with pneumocystis pneumonia at 25, is what's happening in South Africa with young women presenting with end-stage disease at 23. These are the issues that we have to confront, and every day we need to ask ourselves, do we have the right programs, the right outreach, the right message, the right level of concern for a different population that's at risk today than it was yesterday? We have to know the epidemic we have today, not the epidemic we had yesterday, or not, most importantly, the epidemic we would like to have. I work in country after country that would like to have this epidemic, but have this epidemic. An epidemic of men who have sex with men, an epidemic of trans women, an epidemic of people who inject drugs, an epidemic that's expanding in prisons. That's the epidemic they have. That's the epidemic we need to respond to. And that's the epidemic that together we could decrease deaths by 50%, infections by 50%. If we go out there with the models that we have, that we know that work, that you've shown us that work. I was excited about the abstracts that talk about adolescents, the abstracts that talk about PrEP and adherence, the abstracts that talk about young women and pregnant women and remaining adherent, the abstracts that talked about PrEP and ART together. Prevention and treatment aligned for the people who are in relationships. Because we have 35,000 new infections every week, and together we can do better. And we know we can if we allow the data to guide us with that always understanding that at the end of the day, it is a person that we have to reach, not a data point. Thank you for the work that you do, for the time you've taken to teach me to be better at what I do through the programming that you do. It's exciting to be here. I want to thank Jose for his Fast Track Cities initiative. I think it's an insight in how we can end this pandemic for cities. We are excited about that. Kiev, Ukraine has come forward as the newest city. We're trying to co-invest as this develops because we think the Fast Track Initiative brings together that political leadership with policy and science and programming in a way that we had it before that we need again. And we're excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Ambassador Brooks, thanks so much. Just fantastic words of inspiration and vision, and also the challenge and pragmatic ideas of rolling up our sleeves and recognizing it is one individual at a time. I think your two talks couldn't have been more well integrated in terms of focusing domestically and internationally on celebrating the successes, but also addressing the challenges and stepping up. So thank you both.